there is no way we're going to be able to improve the health and well-being of our communities if we don't do a really, really good job at improving the health and well-being of our 12.6 million members. But at the same time, there is no way we can optimize the health and well-being of our members if we're not focusing on the conditions for health in the communities where those members live.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. What would happen if a healthcare system decided its job isn't just to treat illness, but to confront the reasons people get sick in the first place? With over 12 million members, 700,000 nurses, and operations across 8 states and in DC, Kaiser Permanente is certainly a healthcare giant. But KP is also making a big play to address and improve the conditions of health in its own communities. And that means shifting to issues like climate change, workforce pipelines, and tackling the wider social needs of its members. As Chief Health Officer, Bachar Chuker is leading that work at KP, and we are so happy to welcome him to The Other 80 today. Thank you for joining. So many amazing fronts and things to cover, from climate to public health to how do we think about the workforce of the future. So I really look forward to digging in.
Thank you, Claudia, for having me. It's always great to spend time with you.
I'm going to take us back several years. I was privileged to have a conversation with your former CEO, Bernard Tyson, about community benefit and what it meant and the work that you're now leading, both leading your health strategy and community benefits. And he said two things that I found really interesting. One, how might an organization like KP use all of its assets, its privileged place in the delivery system, its buildings, its employees, its ability to convene people and partner, its policy mechanisms, to create health? So not just think about the delivery of care, but really the whole organization. And the second thing was, how do we step back and define health much more broadly to include the air we breathe, the food we eat, whether our communities are safe and healthy as a whole? It's really stuck with me, what he said. And you came in soon after that to be the leader of this work. Does that scoping of those two elements still resonate for you? And if so, how do you think about that broad strategy to use all of the assets and to create a meaning of health that's far broader?
Thank you for starting there. Bernard obviously has a very special spot in my heart and my mind, and will do that forever. He's the person who recruited me to come to Kaiser Permanente, and for the longest, he's been a source of inspiration for me and honestly for thousands of other people within KP and outside of KP. And for me, Claudia, I'm going to go back to our mission as an organization. We're an 80-plus-year-old organization, and we were founded on the premise of making sure that we're an organization that's about improving the health and well-being of our members and improving the health and well-being of our communities. That's been our mission since we were founded. And if you think about it, those go hand in hand. There is no way we're going to be able to improve the health and well-being of our communities if we don't do a really, really good job at improving the health and well-being of our 12.6 million members. But at the same time, there is no way we can optimize the health and well-being of our members if we're not focusing on the conditions for health in the communities where those members live. And I love the name of your podcast, The Other 80. We know that what impacts health does not necessarily just happen within the four walls of our hospitals, of our medical office buildings, in that 15-minute encounter that you have with your doctor. What impacts health happens in our communities. It's where people play, where people learn, where people work, where people pray. And for us to be truthful, to delivering on the mission of this 80 plus year old organization, we have to be thinking about what happens in our communities. And that's at the core of who we are as an organization, at the core of our community and social health strategy for the organization.
One thing we've talked a lot about on this podcast is how does healthcare lean into that much bigger framing while being strategic about its particular role? That's so broad, it becomes somewhat overwhelming. And I guess I would ask, as you take on that much bigger strategy that really has to do with the drivers of underlying health, how do you think about how to be strategic and targeted and effective in what you choose to focus on? So what are some of the decision rules you have about the kinds of things you take on or the kinds of things that you say, those are important, but those can't be ours to focus on?
Yeah, well, that's the almost $4 billion question that we ask ourselves every year as we think about where we allocate our resources to improve health and well-being for our members and our communities from our CB, community benefit investments. To me, Claudia, this goes back to what are we doing to support individuals? What are we doing to engage with the communities? And how are we playing a bigger role in improving policies and systems? And if you think about it along those three pillars, that's how we make our decisions. That's how we engage with our partners. We engage with our employees. We engage with our members. We engage with the community to see where we're going to focus our time and energy and resources. So let's start with individuals. We know that there is no way we can improve health if we don't focus on the individual as a whole. And when we think about health for individuals, we don't just think about their physical health. We don't just think about their mental health. We also think about their social health. And we think about how we integrate all of that together. Look, we have developed protocols and policies and workflows and evidence based around optimizing the physical health of our members and the mental health of our members. And now we're bringing that same rigor to focus on the social health of our members. Do our members have a stable roof over their head? Do they have access to nutritious, healthy food in their communities? Do they have access to enough resources to be able to pay their bills and their copay for their medications? Do they have access to transportation so that they can actually come in and access their care delivery system? So we think about the health of the individual with that comprehensive view of your physical health, mental health, and social health. So that's one angle of how we invest and how we decide on prioritizing resources. The other aspect is how we're engaging with community and community partners. How are we showing up in our communities with lots of humility, with lots of curiosity, and asking the right questions as to where does our community want us to be? How do we support that infrastructure within our communities, the ability of our communities to advocate for itself and grow and be healthy and create the right healthy environments? And then the third pillar is, you know, we know that for us to really optimize health, we have to be thinking about policies. We have to be thinking about systems. So how do we engage with other private sector players, the for-profit entities, government entities, to think about our role on the policy and systems becomes equally as important. And I'm also happy to double click with you on that and talk about our work around the Common Health Coalition to supporting public health infrastructure, or City Health to think about the types of policies we'd like to see in our big cities across the country. And that will be able to kind of paint the picture of how we invest our $3 to $4 billion every year, if you want, in community benefits as an organization.
If you think about the items that are number one on your agenda in each of those buckets, the thing that you really want to get across the line this year versus the longer term things, maybe just click on what those would be in each of those three. So what's the one item that's top of mind for you in the individual, the community, and the policy?
Let's start with individuals. And I do want to double click on the social needs of our members. And look, the majority of our members get their coverage through their employers. So these are folks who are employed. And then when we screened a representative sample of 10,000 of our members back in 2020 and we screened them again in 2022. What we've learned is 2/3 of our members, Claudia, have had at least one unmet social need. That's 2 out of 3. And the majority of our members get their coverage through employers. And then when we looked at our Medicaid members, actually 90% of those members have at least one unmet social need. And what we found out is actually 20% of our members have 3 unmet social needs at the same time. And obviously, you and I know that if you have an unmet social need, that have a direct impact on your health. We've actually learned that our members with social needs are 3 times more likely to rate their health as poor or fair, their physical health, 6 times more likely to rate their mental health as poor or fair. So clearly identifying our members with social need and making sure that we're meeting that need becomes an important part of how we support our members in their journey to health. And when you look at our members' social need, about 1/4 of our members have problems with food insecurity, about 15% have problems with housing stability, and more than half have financial instability concerns. So clearly, there's more that we can do there in supporting our members.
You've really been outspoken, calling to attention the link between climate and health. You've pointed out that if we treat climate change as an abstract scientific element and we can track the warming of the earth, the warming of the ocean, but don't actually talk about the human impact, including on health, we will never make the progress that we need to see. And I think it's interesting to think about taking this on as something that's really important. And you're doing it at 3 levels, which in some ways track back to the same framework you just talked about. You're using your bully pulpit to bring people together to think about this issue and really calling attention to it. You're also making the changes that you need to make internally with your operations to actually create less impact. And you're trying to evolve your care delivery strategy, your health strategy, so that your members in your communities can be more resilient in the face of these changes. And I'd just love to go behind the scenes a little bit with you and learn more about how did you develop this strategy and what have you learned as you've gone about really taking on climate and health as a major part of your overall strategy?
I think where I would start, Claudia, is I think we all agree that climate and health are inextricably linked. We're all feeling and witnessing the impact of a changing climate, whether through severe climate events, whether it's fires or flooding or extreme heat. And we have to be able to think about what role can we play to mitigate that and support people going through the impact of climate. And what I would start with is, our role on carbon emission. And we've been on this journey to try to figure out what role can we play to help us reduce our carbon emission. And we've been on a journey to become carbon neutral. We've actually achieved carbon neutral status from scopes 1 and 2 back in 2020. And we are incredibly proud of the progress that has led us to get there. And we still have a lot more work to do around our suppliers and carbon emission from suppliers. And we're going to continue to do that work there. So that's an important part of the agenda. I think the second part is, as a science-driven, research-driven organization, it's really important to understand where are the gap in the literature of what we know is there, and what are the pieces that we know to develop when it comes to the research better to help us better understand the link between health and climate. And we have partnered with the National Academies of Medicine to help us understand the landscape. The National Academies of Medicine just published a report that identifies where the bodies of research linking climate and health exist. I think the third part to me is the importance of supporting people dealing with particularly climate events that we're dealing with every single day, it seems like it. We've been witnessing fires in just in my tenure at Kaiser Permanente. We have to deal with fires in Santa Rosa, a couple of other places in Northern California, in Oregon, in Colorado, most recently in LA. We're feeling the impact of extended heat waves. We've seen, you know, extended heat waves in Colorado and Portland and other places. And we have to figure out how do we support our members going through some of those challenges. Recently we've gone on an effort to support our members who were recently discharged from the hospital in Portland. And we knew there was going to be an extended heat wave. You know, we've engaged with those members, tried to identify the members who might not have air conditioning at their home, who would need that, and connect them with resources to be able to have an air conditioning at their home to prevent them from having to deal with the impact of that heat wave and then having them to be readmitted to the hospital. And the reality is this body of work is going to continue to evolve. You know, if you have a poor air quality day, what is our role in trying to identify the members who have asthma, who've been to the ED multiple times in the last year because of asthma exacerbation, who might not have had a refill of their inhaler, to make sure that we engage them more effectively? So as you think about extended heat waves, as you think about poor air quality, as you think about fires, we all have a role to play to support people going through those challenges. And I think that's an important part of how we're responding to that space at the intersection between climate and health.
If you were to make an ask of the Berkeley School of Public Health around research that you hope we could do that focus on some of the gaps that you've seen from the NAM report, what might be one or two areas you'd point to?
Just to follow up on our conversation and supporting individuals, where do we need to focus our time and energy on? What's the profile of the members or individuals who might be most impacted by extended heat waves or by poor air quality? What's the right interventions that we need to design and put in place to make sure that we're supporting these people in staying healthy? We're preventing hospitalization. There's a lot to learn as I think about how we've developed the rigor around treating diabetes and treating hypertension. We have to get to that same rigor in designing interventions to supporting people who are dealing with extreme weathers.
That's a great one. You've talked a lot about the need for collective action. A lot of the areas you've chosen to focus on, whether it's the social service infrastructure, climate, workforce, by necessity require those kinds of strategies. What have you learned about how to galvanize that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you my philosophy here. For these types of issues that are so hard to navigate, so hard to solve, there's no one entity that can solve for these issues. If there was one entity that can solve for these complex issues, they would have been solved. So, you know, whether you're thinking about the impact of homelessness or the food insecurity crisis or the access to mental health services or, you know, any of the issues that we've been talking about, it requires an all hands on deck type of an approach. We have to roll up our sleeve and we have to engage other community partners, other healthcare delivery system, other industries, the private sector, the government sector, the for-profit, the not-for-profit sector, the governmental entities. And really, we have to do it in a way that's coordinated, that makes a difference at the end of the day. And that is not for the faint of heart. I mean, that's bottom line. You have to be able to have lots of humility when you're addressing these issues, because these are very complex issues. And that's what I've encouraged our team, encouraged myself to always come to the table with a lot of humility, knowing that lots of the people in the room around the table have better answers than what you have. I think the second piece, Claudia, for me is always have a good sense of curiosity. Ask questions. Don't be embarrassed of asking questions. Learn. Ask questions from so many different people, so many different perspectives, so you can be better informed. So that sense of curiosity, I think, is really important. And I think the third piece is to have the courage to take risk when it's appropriate. And if we don't take risk on decisions and things and programs and policies, sometimes we're not going to find the right solution. So to me, really, it boils down to come to the table with a lot of humility, have a big sense of curiosity to ask questions, and really have the courage to take risk and be able to make a difference. That's very high level, but that's the philosophy, if you want, that I see works.
I think that framework is such a lovely mandate for students and what they should leave schools of public health with. It's far beyond the knowledge, the EPI, the social behavior knowledge, and really to these core leadership skills that I think will serve them well. So we're a week before commencement, so I really thank you for laying out in such beautiful terms what we hope people can learn and take with them as they enter the workforce. Speaking of the workforce, I want to touch for a minute on the mental health workforce. And I'm really excited. My older son is starting a master's in social work program in June at Smith College. And it's been just an amazing journey to help him navigate to deciding that this is the path for him to become a therapist. But it's come with some consternation when we look at the structure of the program. And it's a wonderful program, but still they are expected to do 2 8-month practicums or internships. Generally, they're not at all paid. Maybe you get a little stipend. And so for students, they have to take on the expense of the graduate program itself, and then the expense of working for free for almost 2 years. And then you enter the workforce, and as you've pointed out, many of these students can't afford to get licensed because those requirements are so substantial. And yet we know that there's such a dire need for people who are trained to be therapists and social workers and psychologists and other kinds of lay positions to support our mental health. 1 out of 3 communities doesn't have access to the workforce they need. And I first want you to talk a little bit about this dilemma that we're in this particular space, and then talk a little bit about some of the solutions that you're coming up with as an organization to build out a healthier pipeline and get out of this rock and hard place position in terms of the financing of it.
Thank you, Claudia, for bringing this, and congratulations to your son for committing to be on this journey to be a therapist. This is such an important part of our health ecosystem that needs more and more and more attention. I think you've mentioned in your question, 1 in 5 people in this country have some type of a mental health diagnosis. 1 in 3 live in communities where we don't have enough mental health providers. I think we have 1 mental health provider for every 340 people in this country, and yet 1 in 5 people have a mental health diagnosis, just to give you a sense on the scale of the need there. And what we've learned over the years is that many people go through the program just like your son is going to go through, and yet every year we have about 47,000 master's prepared clinicians or therapists that actually graduate. And then 57% of those never make it to licensing. Think about that for a moment. This is a discipline where we need a lot more therapists. And yet, out of the 47,000 people who finish their master's program, 57% of those never make it to the licensing stage and end up being licensed so that they can provide services. So as we've learned about this, as we've learned to understand what are the drivers behind that lack of path towards licensure, what we've realized is some of the issues that you brought up. You know, many of these folks who are master's prepared have full-time jobs, have families to take care of, and then to ask them that, oh, now you need to do 2,000, 3,000, some are 4,000 hours of supervised hours that might not be paid appropriately. They just simply can't afford it. It's just not possible for them to afford. For others, it's the tests you need to take to get licensed. And maybe you don't have access to the prep schooling that you need or the prep programming so that you can pass your test from the first time. So how do we make sure that we provide the resources there? For others, it's the complexity of finding the supervisors. You're asking these master's prepared therapists to actually get all the supervision that they need, and that costs money, might not be available. You might have to find the exact right type of supervisor depending on your state. And then on top of all of that, add the super complexity of our system across the country, where every state has its own sets of requirements and supervision guidelines and what it takes to get licensed in that state. And then you get licensed in one state, and then you go to move to another state. Then you have another layer of complexity in figuring out how to get your license in the new state that you're in. So this is just a flavor, Claudia, of some of what our master's prepared therapists are having to deal with. And for me, the challenge was, is there a way that we can make a difference to support therapists who are going through these barriers and remove those barriers for them so that they can get to their licensure? So we started this program back in 2023. Incredibly excited about this program because it brings those very concrete barriers and tried to say, hey, how can we work with you as a master's prepared therapist to remove those barriers and get you to licensure? And what we've seen over the last 2 years, and we've started this program in Colorado and in Georgia, and we have now about 125 master's prepared therapists enrolled in this program. We've seen that this program is actually helping these folks, and we've seen an attrition rate of about 13% compared to 30% in other programs. We've seen these folks get to licensure. We're really excited about that. And because of the success of the early two sites in Georgia and Colorado, we've expanded this program now to Southern California, to the state of Washington, to Hawaii, and then we're launching in Oregon later this year. And I had a chance to spend some time, Claudia, with a couple of dozens of these master's prepared candidates in Philadelphia at the National Council for Mental Wellbeing conference last week. And I got a chance to hear their stories and hear how impactful this program has been in their journey to become licensed. And my heart is full from those conversations. It just tells me how important this program is to supporting people getting licensed and really how transformative this program is for those candidates, their families, and equally as important for the people who will benefit from the counseling that those therapists are going to be able to provide.
I mean, it's not often that you get the sort of circular benefit all the way around. So congratulations. Relatedly, you've been doing a ton of work with the Common Health Coalition on, I think, broadly the linkages between public health and healthcare, but more specifically, how to build out the capacity for community health workers in the communities you work in. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that work as well.
Yeah, let me start by just talking a little bit about the Common Health Coalition. I had the privilege of serving as the White House vaccine coordinator under President Biden's first year in office, and it was all about getting people vaccinated. And I think if one thing we've learned through our response to the pandemic, to the COVID-19 pandemic, was that we need more and more bridges between public health and healthcare. For the longest, these two disciplines has operated as two separate, distinct disciplines operating in their own silos. And then we have some bridges built, and then there's a public health emergency. We build more bridges, we strengthen those bridges that already exist. And then when that public health emergency subsides, we all retreat into our own disciplines and we continue that siloed journey. I had the privilege of working at the intersection between public health and healthcare for pretty much my full career. And I became much more convinced as I was part of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic and as we've recovered from this pandemic that we can't afford to live in two siloed systems moving forward. We have to really build those bridges, make them permanent. And we have to actually invest in building those bridges when there isn't a public health emergency. And that's really was at the heart of why we founded the Common Health Coalition. And we said, what role do we have to play as the healthcare industry coming into that space, engaging our public health partners and say, hey, we want to build this together. We'd want to strengthen the interfaces between public health and healthcare together. So that's when the five founding members, Kaiser Permanente, the American Hospital Association, the American Medical Association, AHIP, which represents health plans in this country, and ACHP, representing community health plans, we came together and says, hey, we're going to extend our hand to our public health colleagues and try to build this coalition with the public health community to find areas where we need to strengthen that interface between public health and healthcare. I'm incredibly proud of the work that the coalition has done. We now have over 200 members across the country that truly believe that we need to do more to bridge the gap between public health and healthcare. Focusing on things, Claudia, that we all know are important. How do you build coordination at times where there isn't public health emergency? How do you create MOUs between public health departments and healthcare systems? How do you do emergency preparedness together? How do you exchange data before there is a public health emergency between public health and healthcare? How do we engage around workforce-related matters? So really concrete, no-regret actions that we can take as a country to really bridge the gap between public health and healthcare. If you're not familiar with the Common Health Coalition, please check it out. It's commonhealthcoalition.org. We'd encourage you to join and become part of that coalition.
Yeah, we'll say a little bit about the community health worker piece, because I think certainly in California, what we've seen is with the launch of CalAIM and many other efforts at the community level, I think there's been a broad recognition of the need for this capacity. And one of the things I've heard from many people in the field is there's not really a workforce training infrastructure. Many of the same organizations were fighting for the same workers, and there wasn't always the detailed knowledge and even research to know how to deploy community health workers in the most effective way. So I'm super curious about how this effort might be attacking any of those issues.
You know, as you think about the public health and the healthcare disciplines, I truly believe that community health workers could play a significant role in bridging those two spaces. When we were trying to get people vaccinated in this country and we started to see a lot of vaccine hesitancy, people turned to their doctors, people turned to their nurses. But the reality, people trust people they know. And when people had questions about vaccines, they turned to their neighbors, their friends. You know, if you think about the community health worker, it's this local person who's trusted by the local community, who lives in that local community, who understands the challenges of that local community, who understands the resources in that local community, and who understands the power of your local community in finding solutions and answers to difficult problems and issues that your local community is facing. So the Common Health Coalition issued this challenge to identify organizations across the country that are working on elevating the role of community health workers, standardizing that work, figuring out how we make sure that we're providing the support and the technical assistance and all the important aspects of elevating the role of community health workers as a bridge maker, as a connector between healthcare and the public health systems. For us as an organization, we've experimented with multiple models. And we've had a couple of failures along the way. And now we have a model that we're really, really excited about that we started in our KP Northwest market in the Portland, Oregon area. And we know, and we've studied this in an actual controlled trial, that we've actually have shown that if we assign a community health worker to a certain profile of our members who would benefit the most from that community health worker, you will see improvement in health outcomes. You will see a reduction in total cost of care. We've actually saved 2 hospital days per member per year for those members who were assigned community health workers. And that translated to about $82 per member per month savings for those members. So now we've taken that same exact model, that same profile of members who could benefit from that community health worker. We've taken that actual intervention that we've designed in the Northwest, and now we've expanded that into our Mid-Atlantic market in Virginia, Maryland, and DC. And now we're thinking about what would it take for us to take that model across all of Kaiser Permanente's footprint. This is the type of rigor, Claudia, that we need to bring, and the country honestly need to bring to engage with community health workers and incorporate that model into our care model in general. And look, this is not about medicalizing the role of community health worker. If anything, it's about demedicalizing the good chunk of care that really needs to happen in our communities, as opposed to having it tied into inside the walls of our hospitals and medical office buildings.
And I'll, if you have studies or reports from that work, we're happy to share it in the show notes.
Oh, of course. Yeah, the publication actually just came out that shows the 2 days per member per year reduction, I think a few months back. So I'm happy to send you the link.
I say to other guests, this is the free advice part of the conversation. So I was brought in as the first ever chief social impact officer at the Berkeley School of Public Health. And the framing of it is very similar, I think, to the way you think about the role within KP, which is really, if we're going to be good on the role of universities and not just creating amazing research and not just educating the next generation, but really galvanizing change in the world in a positive direction. What could that look like? What could universities be doing, and specifically public health schools be doing, to be the platforms for the kind of change we need? Now, our tools are a bit different, maybe than a very large delivery system, but I'd love to hear your advice and thoughts, and this is on the fly, for what you would be focusing on if you were in my shoes.
Thank you, Claudia, for the work that you've been doing since you've joined UC Berkeley in that capacity. I was very excited when I saw the role being posted, the profile of the candidates the school was interviewing, and really excited when you landed in that role. I think we all have a role to play in advancing health and well-being across our communities, and schools of public health have a special role. You engage with students, you're building the workforce of the future, you're part of the community, you have researchers and academicians and thought leaders within that environment that can make a big difference. And my advice to you and everybody else in the school is to think about, how do you truly engage with the community in a way that makes sense, in a way that you come to the community with a lot of humility, asking lots of the questions, understanding what the community needs, what the community wants, and try to be able to support, co-design with the community solutions to some of the problems they're facing, and also trying to create innovative opportunities, innovative solutions to things that might be really, really hard to address. That would be my main suggestion, main advice. Truly, deeply engage in the community. Listen, ask lots of questions. Design your priorities based on what you're hearing from the community, and really bring all what you have from expertise, energy, excitement, resources to be able to be a good community partners. That's my two cents here.
I so look forward to continuing to follow your work, finding ways to collaborate, and it's just been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Claudia, for having me.
By now, you're sick of me talking about how necessary, but insufficient it is, to attack the drivers of health at an individual level. We need to provide food as medicine, yes, but we also need to address the crippled food system. Side by side with our work to provide individual services, we need to zoom back and create systems change. The strategies Bechara outlined are not new. Working in partnership, tackling pipelines, building new narratives, creating new capacity. But what is new is the financial commitment by KP, $3 to $4 billion a year, to make the lasting change we need. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Bechara Chuker and his work at Kaiser Permanente. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.